This is Pure Decking for June the 6th, Thursday. What year is this? 2013. This is the show about stuff that interests me. I'm Morps, and tonight we have BSV, Madman, RU486, Sard, and Suave. So we just have most of the IHN panel here. I am sipping on a shot of Patron, and when that's done, I'm going to switch over to zombies. I don't know. BSV, what do you got?
What do you expect?
The blood of the innocent.
I ran out of that. It's expensive
yeah,
to get a hold of.
They're hard to find, aren't they?
This is a very valuable innocent quantity. People in the world.
Madman, what do you got?
I've got Knob Creek on the Rocks, the 9-year-old single barrel. And then I've got Christian Brothers Brandy that I'm going to be starting on after the Knob Creek's done.
Nice. Are you? You're on coffee, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm shaking like a motherfucker right now. I really got to cut down, man. Stop drinking 6 shots of espresso at once.
Well, especially if you, you know, get all the shots on the table and just chain them.
That can lead to heart palpitations.
They're all in one cup.
Oh, it's like, even better.
Yeah.
All right, Sarge, what do you got?
The machine says it makes for 7.
Mountain of the Dew.
Mountain Dew.
Yeah, I know.
I think, are you just...
See, and that's why I drink it.
All right,
it makes,
Swab,
are you
got?
Have...
spasms. I cracked a coconut earlier, so I had a bunch of coconut milk. Or coconut juice, and so I added a bunch of rum to it, and that is what I'm drinking.
You're in Canada! How does a Canadian even find the taste for coconut milk?
Haven't heard of international trade, have you?
I haven't left my house all week. What does
Very
that
nice.
Tell you?
Very nice. A little bit of station news. I'm expecting some very minor downtime this weekend as I think I'm going to have to move the broadcast box for some of the stuff I'm doing around the house. So I may have to shut the thing down for a little bit. But we've got 22 consecutive days of uptime. That's pretty damn good. So yeah, if it's going to be down, it's not going to be more than an hour. Just a heads up there. And I've been exploring starting a new show. It's not I'm Right. Tentatively I'm looking at Fridays 7 o'clock my time, 8 o'clock Eastern, and right now the best name I have for it is The Drinking Show. Essentially the first 5 minutes of decking where we're all talking about what alcohol we have, we're just going to turn that into a full show. So
sounds good,
homebrew,
man. Awesome. That'll be fun. Homebrew,
yeah.
Reviews and stuff like that.
Homebrew, pick out alcohol, and we're going to get Rofaxin on it since he actually knows how to review alcohol. So,
can you teach me how to make bathtub gin? The traditional 1920s way?
We can look it up.
I think that should be part of it. You know, each week, one of the prohibition ways of brewing alcohol.
Well, I've got a batch of hooch that's about done, so...
We're in the right part of the country to bring professors on to actually teach how to make moonshine that won't turn you blind.
There you go.
That's an important skill.
Go take my little pocket recorder out and talk to a professor and just record it. Yeah. So, I was probably looking at maybe every other week on Fridays. So, I do every week, but I've been punishing the liver for years, and it's starting to retaliate. What?
Look forward to it, man. That'll be cool.
I was like, nobody's going to respond to that joke. Okay. All right. Well,
it's a lifestyle, not a joke, man. You're making fun of my lifestyle. This is some country's national heritage you're fucking joking about here, man.
So, is Australia one of the countries that you can be shot on site for wasting alcohol? I forget. There's a couple of them.
Yes, there's Ireland as well, I understand. The Scots as well, British as well, and pretty much everywhere bar America.
And America's the only one with easy access to guns anymore.
Yeah. We didn't leave hell, they let me have with one, a dead so. Kangaroo.
All right. So, moving on to our discussion topic. Looking ahead at some of the stories, you'll see why I thought this was worth talking about. Hard disk encryption and keeps coming up in a legal sense. The guy last week we were talking about who was being forced to decrypt his hard drives, now the judge has changed his mind, and now they don't have to decrypt them. Plus, there's the whole Verizon thing. And if you think Verizon's the only telecom that the government is doing that to, you're in for a surprise.
And I believe that story actually broke, what was it, 2006, 2008, something like that?
I believe,
and then everybody conveniently
in 08,
forgot about it.
In the story, they actually talk about how the program started under Bush, but apparently a document for a recent one leaked. So everyone was shocked that it's been going on ever since. So
I'm actually surprised that people are shocked about this.
Oh, like, Obama was going to stop
everybody
all that,
Everybody was aware
man.
Of it. Yeah, but he didn't say that he stopped it.
No, of course not. It just everyone kind of assumed. So, like, yeah, bullshit, he's going to stop that. So, anyways, and they do justify it with terrorism, by the way, which is even funnier.
Of course.
Fear.
So, in a legal sense, we're not talking about, you know, crappy encryption or something that you can be cracked over time or, you know, brute forcing passwords or anything like that. We're talking in a purely legal sense. Should the court system, you know, with a judge, maybe just the police without a judge, be able to force you to decrypt a digital storage system, whether it's a hard disk or a transmission, or I mean, we're talking hard disks in the case, but with the whole Verizon thing, that's transmission. So are we talking anything, your cell phone, the flash drives in your pocket? So I can kind of see both ways, because I've been on the investigative side of things, and I can certainly understand what a fuck ton it is when you hit an encrypted file and you can't crack it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like, oh, fuck. Now, a lot of times you'll get really lucky and find passwords.xls somewhere on, you know, on like the desktop, and that'll get you past some of that. But, you know, occasionally you'll just get that encrypted drive, and, well, fuck. You're done, right?
That's the way it should be, I think. I mean, the whole Fifth Amendment, you can't self-incriminate, so I don't think they should be able to force decryption.
Well, regardless of the Fifth, even for countries that don't have that sort of protection, I don't think it should be legislated for the sole reason it cannot be enforced. You know, like, you could legislate all you want, saying, oh yeah, you have to give us your password, we're allowed to interrogate you for your password, blah blah blah. Okay, yeah, sure, I'll enter my password. Huh. It's not working. Oh, gee, I must have forgotten it. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know my password.
What? Okay, now flip that around. What if you've legitimately forgotten your password? Because if you look at the way the legal system works, at least in the States, These things can take years, and you know it's got to be high stress. So, well, they took that computer and that hard drive set from you 2 years ago, and Lord knows you quit using that same password when they took all that, right? So, you know, at least if you've got any modicum of intelligence, you quit using the password that, you know, matches the system they're trying to take, you know, get into. So if, you know, you're using a different password now, what if you legitimately forgot?
Absolutely.
And, you know, are you just going to jail forever for contempt of court because you forgot a password?
Yeah, that's another great reason not to legislate something like that. Like, I honestly think that in some situations they should be able to get it, but they don't. It's impossible. They can't.
So they've been forcing decryption for years, though. You're thinking it's new because, in an electronic sense, it is. But Al Capone, they forced his bookkeeper to decrypt their encrypted books. It was pen and paper encryption, and probably easier to brute force nowadays, but they had no way of reading any of the books they used to convict Al Capone until they forced the bookkeeper to decrypt them.
How did they case,
how did they force him, though? I mean, all he did was take a plea deal because
put him
was
in jail forever.
Exactly. So he's just saving his own skin. That's kind of different. I mean, if you give them your password for a plea deal, I think that's something completely different. I think this is...
Well, there is a very important point there. They didn't convict Al Capone's bookkeeper with what they got from the books. I'm sure they convicted him on something. But they wanted that evidence specifically to go after somebody else, right?
According to racketeering, the bookkeeper could be charged with murder, with everything that Al Capone was charged with. But the only reason he wasn't is they offered him a deal in exchange for his testimony, and then implied that if he didn't help them, they would leak that he did help them and then put him in general population.
Oh, damn. That's okay. That's wow. But the big argument against being forced to provide a password is self-incrimination for the amendment. They were offering him a deal. That's a little different.
Yeah.
It's not an exact... It's a good point. Don't misunderstand, but it's not an exact corollary. So, now, I don't know, though. I know where I fall down on this. I don't think they should have a legal stance on forcing you to decrypt anything. But I'm libertarian. So, I think, you know, it's like, yeah, if you want to prosecute me, good luck, here you go. But, that's a personal thing, but from a, I guess what you'd say, an administrative side, I can certainly understand how crazy difficult it makes things. You know, because if you can't force decryption, you know, what if you've got what if you genuinely have a scumbag, and you've got no other way to go after this guy except for the data that's all tied up. Apparently, according to what you just said, they couldn't go after Al Capone until they found some way to crack his books.
They didn't have anything to take him down with.
Yeah.
That's why he was never charged with murder. It's not that he didn't kill people. He admitted to it later on when he was in prison. Or having people killed. It's that they couldn't prove anything.
So, you know, again, I mean, yeah, if they had a legal stance of forcing you to provide a password to a computer, that would not protect an Al Capone, but I think the harm that would do is a lot greater than the, you know, the good you could do with that kind of thing.
Exactly. It's a punishing the few for the, or punishing the many for the few type thing.
Yeah. Now for the next thing, do you think someone having an encrypted file or drive implies guilt? Like there, you know, in the story we're going to talk about, which we've been going over and over again, you know, they're going after the guy for kiddie porn, and they haven't charged him yet. I think they're going to, because in the last story, they finally got into one of the drives and found stuff to prove that it was his, and, you know, found file names. But, you know, they haven't actually charged him yet because they haven't got any evidence, but they're holding this stuff and keep going back to court trying to get this guy to, you know, trying to force him to decrypt the drives so they can charge him. I mean, do you think having anything encrypted implies that, you know, you've got something you need to hide?
It can, because websites, I mean, essentially, the layman probably has heard what encrypted means, but they probably don't understand it. I mean, doesn't Gmail automatically default to HTTPS? So,
yes,
I mean, stuff is encrypted even without you having a choice. So I don't think it can imply guilt
actively,
because you don't have a choice even in that sense to turn it off type thing. No?
I think at work I give people laptops that are encrypted already. I mean, for international travel machines, we encrypt it. Really just in case the machine's lost or stolen, regardless of whatever goes on it, you know, it could just be nothing. It could be a Windows install and that's it. But we encrypt all the hard drives just in case.
Yeah, you know, like, I think it can be used as evidence in certain situations. For example, if they arrest a man for abducting a kid or something like that, they go back to his house and they find a hard drive with a big label on it saying kiddie porn, but it's encrypted. I feel like they should be able to submit that as, you know, part of the case against this guy. But, it would have to be taken on a case-by-case basis. And I think the mere fact that it's encrypted, it shouldn't be what convicts somebody. It's the context in which it is encrypted.
Well, I tell you, one of the other reasons I recommend people encrypt drives is it actually helps protect against malware. If you ever go look up the Blue Pill series of malware, it actually tries to. It uses the built-in virtualization that most processors have now to wrap your operating system in a virtual layer and run code beneath it. And if the hard drive's encrypted, they can't do that. Same thing with a lot of the malware that governments like to dump on people's machines when they go through customs. If the drive's encrypted, their little flash drive to load it on there, it just isn't going to work. So, I mean, I recommend that a lot just for sanity's sake, just for data verification, if nothing else. But, I mean, we're going to see it at some point where it'll be on, you know, some news story. This guy had an encrypted drive on him as he tried to cross the border. He must be hiding something horrible. I mean, you all know we're going to see it. Anybody?
I'm just waiting for the day when someone asks me, "Hey, old man, what were the days like when you had hard drives before the cloud?"
Oh, God.
It's coming, man.
That's the case with the cloud. Everything's stored somewhere else anyway, so you don't have any control over it.
Nope. It's coming, man. It's only going to take... And I hate making the show sound more negative than it already is in dystopian ways.
No, I specifically got some good stories. The first story I'm going with tonight is a positive one.
It's only going to take a small catalyst now for the whole thing just to go... Right, nobody can be trusted anymore. Too many terrorists, too many blah, blah, blah. No more hard drives for anyone. Or you're going to have to be licensed.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, I honestly think it's going that way where eventually you'll have to have an operator's license to use anything more than like a tablet.
Yeah, you're going to need an operator's number to get online. You know, you're going to have your number and things like that, and then everything's going to be tagged to you and... God, I hate the world.
So, well, okay. What about the idea of building in forced backdoors like the FBI currently wants? Is that any different than a legal compulsion to provide the password? I actually think it is.
It is different.
Well, personally,
and the forced backdoor? Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say with the backdoor, somebody else can find it, whereas... With the legal compulsion to provide the password, you're not circumventing the technology. You're basically forcing someone to hand over the key.
And it can be used at any time without provocation, you know?
Yeah.
Well, see my previous statement from last week's show, 5 minutes online, quick, pull the cable out, quick, just hide the data. You know? You'll be physically removing yourself offline whenever you can. You'll be online... to do the minimum amount of things, and then offline straight away. Anybody is looking to safeguard anything. Or they're going to have their everyday look. This is Joe Bloggs hiding within plain sight. And there's the hidden laptop in the ammo case under the bed wrapped in Grandma's old doona that only comes out of full cover of darkness, you know, to be jacked into some stolen bit of tech that you've got off some fucking street vendor at the night. Markets. It's coming, man. I seriously think it's coming.
I don't disagree with you. That's the sad part.
With all the stupid laws and things like that, and I just know what it's like. You cannot get anonymous internet in this country. You can't buy an anonymous mobile phone. You can't buy a burner unless you're buying it off the black market. And I'm seeing more. Those prices are actually going up because people are wanting them. So if you got any SIM cards,
sending burner phones to Australia.
Yeah, SIM cards, man.
So,
I'd like to thank Fox Wolf for that SIM card he left me.
So, interesting business proposal.
SIM cards are cheap here, and postage on them would be next to nothing.
Yeah, you got to get them activated, though. That's the problem, is getting onto the network.
You can get a blank off eBay. Huh. All right, well...
Anyway, before I get arrested, move along.
So, I don't know. I personally don't want to see any kind of a legal compulsion to provide passwords or or forced backdoors in the developers and the systems, just because those systems are going to be so rife for abuse.
I'd be opposed to the forced backdoor because there's nothing preventing the government from using it all the time. At least with forcing someone to give like a password, they have a lawyer there that can challenge everything that the government's doing.
You'd think that. Wait till I talk about this.
I'm not saying they would always win or that the lawyer would be good enough to do that, but the possibility is there, and at least it's out in the open. You know when you're being screwed over. With a backdoor, you're not going to know that the FBI is looking at you.
That's a fair point. But actually, when we get to the story on the guy being forced to do his hard drive, it turns out his lawyers weren't present when they were decided to force him to decrypt his hard drives the first time.
Grounds for appeal?
Yeah, that's right, one of the things they appealed on. Yeah. So, good news.
As long as we have
appeal too.
So long as we have an open judiciary, which we still do, they might do something stupid, but it can immediately be appealed, and even if they succeeded in getting the hard drive decrypted, they wouldn't have been able to use it in court.
Now that would have been the way to go, wouldn't it? Force them to provide the password, then get all that thrown out so they can't use the evidence at all. Of course, then the scumbag gets off, because at this point they're fairly certain he's got kiddie porn. So, oh well. Anyways, let's go ahead and move on to stories here. First one up is from fizz.org. Scientists at the Department of Energy's Oak Ridge National Laboratory have designed and tested an all-solid lithium-sulfur battery with approximately four times the energy density of conventional lithium-ion technologies that power today's electronics. The ORNL battery design, which uses abundant, low-cost elemental sulfur, also addresses flammability concerns experienced by other chemistries. Our approach is a complete change from the current battery concept of two electrodes joined by a liquid electrolyte, which has been used for the last 150 to 200 years, said Chinggu Lang, leader of the ORNL study published this week in Angewaltate Kimi International Edition. I'm thinking I'm saying that one right. Scientists have been excited about the potential of lithium-sulfur batteries for decades, but long-lasting, large-scale versions of commercial applications have been proven elusive. Researchers were stuck with a catch-22 created by the battery's use of liquid electrolytes. On one hand, the liquid helped conduct ions through the battery by allowing lithium polysulfide compounds to dissolve. The downside, however, was the same dissolution process caused the battery to prematurely break down. So they couldn't get it to work because the sulfur, they could get it to work, but the sulfur would just eat through everything. But ORNL team overcame these barriers by synthesizing a never-before-seen class of sulfur-rich materials that could conduct ions as well as the lithium metal oxides conventionally used in batteries' cathode. Lang's team then combined the new sulfur-rich cathode with the lithium anode and a solid electrolyte material also developed at ORNL to create an energy-dense, all-solid battery. So let's skip that. They got the new battery is at 1,200 milliamp hours per gram after 300 discharge cycles at 60 degrees. A comparison of a lithium ion battery of the same settings gets 140 to 170 milliamp hours per gram. So they've got the next iteration of battery technology done. They've got it working in the lab.
Nice. Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, but four times.
I just want to point out that I've seen so many news articles about somebody who's come up with the next battery that's going to revolutionize the electronics industry, and then you hear nothing about it ever again.
True.
So I am very hopeful. But like,
we're probably looking at 5 years at a minimum before this stuff hits market.
The one thing that concerns me is they give you values based on 300 charge discharge cycles. What about 1,000, or 5,000? Like 300, that's not a lot. You have that in a smartphone. That's going to last you maybe a year. And that's not a lot of time. And like, does it have a sharp drop off? What's what's the long-term viability of a battery like this? Like, I don't want a battery that can hold four times as much but dies in a quarter of the time.
You're asking me questions I don't have the answer to.
Oh, no, no, I know. I'm just saying, like, that's why I'm not holding my breath.
I'm not saying hold your breath. I'm just saying it's cool because the possibility now exists because...
Oh, yeah.
I've seen lots of articles, you're right, about the next iteration of batteries, but most of them sounded pretty far-fetched. This one's just they found a better chemical for it and found a way to do it.
Yeah.
So it looks
promising.
And it
sounds like they've actually done it.
Yeah. Although, you know, Sard's right. Sard. Suave's right that, you know, it's only 300 discharges. I wonder if that's all they've had time to do since, you know, they published the paper. But, again, this is cool.
That's a good
point. Maybe 5 years from now, we'll have better batteries as opposed to having to cut the power consumption of electronics down. We can actually have batteries that last a little bit longer, which would be cool. Because I know that's been a big stumbling block in laptops and phones for a while now, is that, well, in hell, it's the problem I have with my phone. A lot of people with Android have with their phones. You just run the battery down so damn fast if you're using the phone.
Yep.
So.
Big time.
Yep.
All right. Well, I tried to open with a happy story, but, you know, Suave with his bucket of ice water there, so.
Bad Suave. Sorry. My bad. I've become too cynical. What can I say?
You've been listening to my show too long. Okay, next one up is from The Guardian. Everyone knows this story. The National Security Agency is currently collecting telephone records of millions of U.S. customers of Verizon, one of America's largest telecom providers, under a top-secret court order issued in April. The order, a copy of which has been obtained by The Guardian, requires Verizon on an ongoing daily basis to give the NSA information on all telephone calls in its systems, both within the U.S. and between the U.S. and other countries. The document shows for the first time that under the Obama administration, the communication records of millions of U.S. citizens are being collected indiscriminately and in bulk, regardless of whether they are suspected of any wrongdoing. The Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISA, granted the order to the FBI on April 25th, giving the government unlimited authority to obtain the data for a specified 3-month period ending in July 19th. Under the terms of the blanket order, numbers of both parties on a call are handed over, as is location data, call duration, unique identifiers, and the time and duration of all calls. I think they said duration twice. The contents of the conversation itself are not covered, so they're not recording you. They're just getting everything else about the call. Under the Bush administration, officials and security agencies had disclosed to reporters the large-scale collection of call records data by the NSA, but this is the first time significant and top-secret documents have revealed the continuation of this massive practice under President Obama. No one is surprised. The unlimited nature of the records being handed over to the NSA is extremely unusual. FISA court orders typically direct the production of records pertaining to a specific named target who is suspected of being an agent or of a terrorist group or foreign state, or a finite set of individually named targets. The Guardian approached the NSA, the White House, and Department of Justice for comment. They all declined. The court order bars Verizon from disclosing to the public either the existence of the FBI's request for its customer records or the court order itself. So, skip a bit. It is not known whether Verizon is the only cell phone provider to be targeted with such an order. Yeah, sure they are. Although previous reporting has suggested the NSA has collected call records from all major mobile networks. It is also unclear from the leaked document whether the 3-month order was a one-off or latest in a series of similar orders. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Short version of it is the FBI is collecting, we know from Verizon, and we can suspect from all major telecoms, call records of everyone in bulk.
Well, and you know, on top of that, I can pretty much guarantee you that every single text message that is sent is also recorded. And I honestly wouldn't be surprised if even voice calls were recorded and stored. I don't know if anybody remembers, but that NSA guy who came out blowing the whistle on, like, the massive amount of data that they've got stored on every single American citizen. They're, like, building new data centers all the time and just filling them up, like, in short amount of time. And they don't even know what to do with all of this data at this point. They're just collecting everything, and they'll come up with a good use for it later.
Oh, that's a good point. It is probably it's a massive amount of data. You know that. I mean, anybody getting freaked out, it's like, oh my God, the FBI knows who I've been talking to. Well, they still have to find a reason to go in and search that database for it. You know what I mean? So, unless they've got a flag on a specific number, they're not going to come knocking on your door right away unless you give them a reason. But they've collected all this data.
And that's the scary part.
We now have evidence that they've been doing it to Verizon. You know they're doing it to AT&T. You know they're doing it to every other telecom. And, you know, oh, it's only this 3-month order. No, you know this has been going on ever since Bush started it. It's gone on the entire time under Obama. And I know people who thought Obama was going to put an end to all this crap. So, bullshit. And you're right. They're probably getting text messages. And, you know, they're like, oh, well, we don't know if it's this one specific thing or it's been gone. You know it's been ongoing. Of course it's been gone ongoing. It's a secret court. Of course it's been gone ongoing. If it wasn't ongoing all the time, the court wouldn't need to be secret.
Good point.
Somebody get a black bag for that man's head. He knows too much.
So anybody else have anything on that? I can move on. It's just everyone's going nuts about this right now, so of course I got to talk about it.
And what's it going to change? What exactly are you and I going to change about that?
Absolutely nothing.
Is there anything that the listener can do?
They can adopt your model, throw the cell phone into the river, and run like hell.
This is a good start. How about just turning off the phone? Find other ways to communicate. How about we find a better way of doing it? How about just talking to each other again in the street? You know, hey, quick phone call. Hey, bud, I'll meet you here. Click. You know, things like that.
Now shouldn't talk to a person 5 feet away from you through your cell phone.
Are you texting across the room you can get rid of? But the big problem with what they're doing is it's going to prevent or at least slow down the assembly of groups and organizations between large numbers of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can talk to my friends face-to-face. But let's say I want to start a political movement or a new company. I'll be going online and talking to bunches of people. If it's a political movement, then I'm going to be getting targeted, and everything I'm trying to set up is going to be monitored.
Yeah, well, but you shouldn't be setting up a political group that's dissident like that. A day you think
I'm not planning to overthrow the government. I'm not attempting to overthrow the government. I'm attempting to win an election.
Been given two choices. Accept your two choices. You don't need a third.
I want six choices. I know they're all going to eventually suck, but then I get to rotate through the what part of my body gets raped.
Wow.
If you notice, the two parties like screwing you different ways. What if I just want six different ways to get screwed?
Wow.
That's just weird. I was just going to say, this is kind of fits in with the other story about it's going to, I don't know, but more prevalent encryption technologies to encrypt that traffic that's going, and hopefully in the future they won't be able to force you to decrypt all that data that they have on you. And it'll just be a bunch of random letters and numbers that mean absolutely nothing.
I like your fantasy world.
They're forcing Verizon to give them the stuff, so wouldn't they also be able to decrypt it?
If you did the encryption and not Verizon, if you're using Verizon's method of encryption, then yeah, they could probably just hand it over. But this isn't even, you know, they're saying they're not getting the contents of the data stream, they're just getting connection information. I've done network forensics. The connection information a lot of times is enough. So there's that. But I just don't want anybody to be under the illusion that this is something new or something brief. This has been going on, and you just have to assume everything you've done for the past decade that's touched a network connection is probably logged somewhere. Doesn't mean anybody's actively looking through it, but you have to assume it's logged.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do the next one. It's from CNET. Jeffrey Feldman has won a reprieve from a federal court order that has given him until Tuesday to decrypt his hard drives for the FBI or face contempt of court. A federal judge in Wisconsin today granted the emergency motion filed by Feldman's attorney for additional time to establish that her client's Fifth Amendment right to self-incrimination would be violated. U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa lifted the threat of contempt of court and jail time, at least temporarily, and asked for additional briefs from Feldman's attorney and Justice Department prosecutors. A hearing is likely to take place this fall. The Wisconsin case, in which an FBI agent accused Feldman of possessing underage porn, is the latest to test the limits of the Fifth Amendment in the digital age. The Fifth Amendment says that nobody shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, which has become known as the right to avoid self-incrimination. Feldman's attorney, Robin Shiloh, argued in an emergency motion filed yesterday that a previous magistrate judge had no authority to issue an order to require her client to decrypt his Western Digital MyBook and Maxter Black Armor hard drives. Nice advertising there, buddy. The brand names of the drives in the freaking story. Of approximately 20 terabytes of storage. My God, man. About 80% is encrypted, the government claims. 20 terabytes. That's... And how old this case is, that's a lot of external drives. Shiloh also argued that the decryption order was improper because the previous proceedings were held before a magistrate judge with only prosecutors, not defense counsel, permitted to attend. Judge Randa agreed and requested both sides submit additional arguments in briefs before briefs due in July and August. FBI agent Brent Banner said that in an affidavit, the Bureau obtained a warrant to seize hard drives and other electronic gear from Feldman's house in January 2013. Okay, this might not be the same story I'm thinking of, because the one I'm thinking of has been going on a little bit longer. So, okay, maybe it's not that many external drives. They found 20 terabytes of hard drives, but agents in Milwaukee field office could not break the encryption despite spending over 10 weeks working on the task. Banner said agents did find evidence that suggests Feldman was using a peer-to-peer program called eMule to exchange files with titles suggestive of child pornography. So they went and pulled his eMule logs. yeah, and of course the Supreme Court hasn't touched Fifth Amendment on hard drive encryption yet. So, yeah. They've got network logs and suspicious file names out of eMule. And that is a lot of hard drives. I don't think I have 20 terabytes of space. And you all know what I do.
Well, at the risk of helping him do it better, why are they labeling their files in retarded fucking child porn descriptive names?
Like, I have no idea.
Like, continue doing it, guys. It's great. Like, you know.
But are
I'm assuming they're not very
20
bright.
Terabytes. Yes, they're probably not all full. That's a lot of files.
Yeah, I understand that. But are they all labeled, like, correctly? Of what the content of each video or picture is? Are you...
There's only so many cartoon shows and other things that you could use as the name of the file to... I don't even know how you would masquerade that. I mean, what would you go with? Music albums or something?
001.
Justin Bieber songs.
002. Yeah. Yeah, and then A001, B001.
So you wouldn't know what it is either. You'd have to open every file to find the one you're looking for. Oh,
don't
there's
forget
the sick
to
piece of horrible
no,
thing
I
I'm
use,
wanting to find.
I use a, because I've got dyslexia, file names don't mean shit to me. So I rename everything A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, right down through with 001. Big will tell you, he's seen heaps of files come through from me with just zero zeros on it. And I know what A is, what B is. They're all different labels.
Okay.
So I know exactly where everything is, but it's just done in numerical order for me, where it's easier that way to scan it.
So they'll need Al Capone's bookkeeper to decrypt your hard drive.
Well, it almost is a sort of like my own decryption. My own encryption, sorry. And then a lot of it's labeled in... how would you put it? Phonetic spelling. So if you're trying to spell it the correct way, like even doing a file search, you ain't going to find it.
Another Yeah, actually, I was going to say something about hiding files, but I'm not, because I don't want to give any sickos out there tips.
Yeah, I'm hoping the sickos aren't listening to my show.
Yeah, pretty much same.
I'm going to be talking about Tor in Digital Dojo, so I'm really hoping they're not listening.
Fair enough.
Have you been on Tor? I think they already know about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just saying. Sickos already know about Tor.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be busting their cherry with that one. They're going to go, wow, did you hear Pure Decking?
Could you have used a worse analogy there for what we're talking about? You know what? Rocket Snail. NewYorkTimes.com. As social media sites pursue advertising in a bid for new revenue, they are finding that they must simultaneously create a safe place for the advertisers to stay attracted. With the money they're discovering comes responsibility. Facebook learned that the hard way last week. After failing to get the social network to remove pages glorifying violence against women, feminist activists waged a digital media campaign that highlighted marketers whose ads were found alongside these pages. Nissan and several smaller advertisers temporarily removed their ads from the site. So, just to clarify a little bit, you had people setting up violence against women Facebook groups.
Okay,
and then ads for like Nissan were showing up on the page because Facebook puts ads on everything, right? And so the feminist activists just like recorded every ad they saw on the hate group page and then contacted them and were like, yeah, you know what you're supporting with your ads? And you know, did the whole ad attack thing to take out a media company.
What the fuck? That's retarded.
No, it was an organized raid. It was over that. There's been a minor kerfuffle going on. Most people know about it. You know, the whole dongle thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is sort of stemming
from this is related
that.
To that?
Yeah, and there was a raid going on. And once the ad company started pulling their ads, more and more people jumped on and started making hateful comments towards women on feminist websites.
Well, that sounds like something that would happen on the internet, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sort of got a little out of control to where it made mainstream media. That's the only reason we're hearing about it. But this has been an ongoing battle with certain groups on different boards rating feminist websites for shits and giggles. Because no one else is getting pissed off anymore and screaming and yelling back at them. Feminists are pretty easy to troll.
Hey, when you want to clip that out, that's at 4240. It's just a little one-liner right there.
It's actually been quite an amusing campaign by a certain bunch of individuals out there causing shit like this on Facebook because they don't like Facebook and they hate feminism. And I, for one, am getting a real good giggle out of it.
Let me get back to the story here because it gets funnier. As public pressure mounted, Facebook acknowledged that its system to identify and remove such content has not worked effectively and promised to improve the process. The company began removing the pages in question. The episode underscored a conundrum for social media sites forged from the philosophy that free speech should thrive on the internet. Will they be able to control content created by their users so that advertisers are not embarrassed by the material beyond their control? So, yeah, because you're putting ads on a page and then accepting user content. Certainly, advertisers have a singular purpose. They want to reach consumers in a positive way, said David Reuter, the vice president for corporate communications at Nissan Americas. It's up to social companies to create an environment that provides a level of support and safety for the companies. Well, if they've got that, then nobody's going to want to use the freaking social network. Anyways, Nissan immediately began working with Facebook to find a solution, Mr. Reuter said, and the brand has resumed advertising on the site. Mr. Reuter praised Facebook for acting quickly and said the company assured us that Nissan will be able to opt out of advertising on any pages that may be deemed offensive. Dove, another brand that activists cited for having ads on Facebook pages denigrating women. Again, these people had no control over where their ads were showing up. I just love this. Said in a statement that it was working with Facebook to have such pages removed. We are also refining in our targeted terms in any case, or in case any further pages like these are created. said Stacey Bright, Global Director of Marketing Communications for Dove, which is owned by Unilever. Facebook Marketing Communications for Dove, read the same line twice. Facebook advertising targets people's interests, not pages, and we do not select the pages. Yeah, that's true. The ads are based on user, not on the pages, so that's even better. Yeah, exactly how there is unclear, blah, blah, blah. Facebook is working to... Basically, Facebook's going to try to put in a filter so that if a page is flagged as offensive, ads just won't show up there. But, of course, it's not preemptive. Somebody has to actually flag it as offensive first. But this is hilarious.
Let's say I want to set some streaming up on Facebook, which happens, and I don't want to see ads while I'm watching these streaming videos on this guy's Facebook page. I can flag that it's offensive, and then I get ad-free streaming on Facebook.
Yeah, everything on Facebook's just going to be flagged as offensive to get rid of the ads.
Nice one, Madman.
I like it. Well, I mean, it's funny to me because this is where the censorship is going to come from on social media. It's, we don't want our Nissan ad appearing next to a Facebook page, you know, where people are, you know, making fun of women or black people or Mac users or something. And so they're the ones who are going to institute the censorship because they don't want their brand associated with whatever the hell is showing up on the page.
All this would have, if they just ignored it, it would have gone away in 24 hours.
You're probably right.
Because I know I was watching the raid when it was happening, and they were asking for the most female-friendly products to raid next.
They finally figured out, you know, these activist groups have figured out a strategy that moderately works for going after media companies, which is to target the groups that advertise on them. Because, I mean, they've been using the strategy against a bunch of conservative talk radio lately. Now they're doing it to Facebook. I think there was something else they were doing it on too, but I can't remember, where essentially they just get all their members of their organizations to start calling whatever company's ads they saw associated with something they didn't like and complain. And the idea is to get the advertising pulled to eventually shut down whatever they don't like. So, but it's a common tactic, and apparently it's effective because they keep doing it.
It works on both sides, man.
That's
it works.
True.
If you don't like a show, start posting anti-female comments about it. So if you want to have the view shut down, target its advertisers. We can use it for our benefit too.
I want to see the view shut down for anti-feminist view.
That would be hilarious. As I say, I think that would be a little difficult for certain groups.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
That was just one show to target, you know.
Anti-Semitic. We can say they're anti-Semitic.
I think everyone can be said to be anti-Semitic at some point or another by accident.
I'm just going with shutting them down.
Yeah, true.
Can Mel Brooks be anti-Semitic? He's a Jew. Can a Jew be anti-Semitic?
I don't know.
Yes. Yes.
Well, there's that racist black guy.
Actually, hang on. Belvedere, get my 60-foot pole, please. This conversation's getting into dangerous territory. Now we
Let
can
me
talk.
Just, I think I'm just going to declare rocket stale and go to the next one here. From Ars Technica, feds say they can search your laptop at the border, but won't say why. Under the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, Americans are generally protected from unreasonable searches and seizures by government agents. But we generally have less privacy at the border, usually when entering the United States from abroad. At present, border agents do not have to provide a warrant or have a reasonable suspicion to search your laptop. They just need a hunch. For some time now, civil liberties groups have been pressing to change that policy. At the very least, these groups would like to compel the government to explain its legal rationale. The Department of Homeland Security says that it definitely can't change its policies to be suspicion-based, and it would be operationally harmful. And from their own report, first, commonplace decisions to search electronic devices might be open to litigation challenging the reasons for the search. So, in other words, they don't want to justify why they're searching your device, because then they might be asked to justify why they're searching the device. In addition to interfering with a carefully constructed border security system, Yeah, bullshit. The litigation could directly undermine national security by requiring the government to produce sensitive investigation and national security information to justify some of the most critical cases. In other words, you have to let the Border Patrol look at your browser history for national security and shut the hell up.
Can they do this to non-U.S. citizens coming into the country?
Apparently they're doing it to damn near anybody. I cut it out of the story, but they are talking about how the numbers of machines actually searched is fairly low for the amount of traffic they have. But, I mean, still, they won't provide a legal rationale because then they might have to defend it. That's essentially what they're saying.
That's dangerous territory.
Yeah, they're actually searching. You think it's like browser history? They explicitly say that.
It's laptops and other electronic devices. I said browser history because I'm sure that's something they're looking at.
Yeah, I've always heard of that. You know, okay, turn the laptop on to prove that it's not just a shell of a laptop and you're hiding something inside. I've never heard of them actually going in looking at browser history or what files you have on there.
I've never had them ask me to turn the laptop on, just put it through the X-ray. Which I'm sure that's great for the drives, but and the screen, now that I think about it. But no, I mean this is you know, entering or exiting the country. They're doing these kind of searches. And again, the numbers in their own report are fairly low. And everyone acknowledges they're not doing a lot. But they are basically just randomly searching people's machines looking for whatever. And they're not justifying it because they might have to defend their justification. I'm summarizing a lot out of the story, so you might want to go to the...
I can see it now. TSA is going to be all right. Okay, bomb inspections will be Jamal, Asklamik, Mohammed, and Ted. And Jingping Wang Chung, your laptop, please. Hang Fang Kung Kai, and Brian. Please, that's how it's going to work.
And you know why they picked Ted and Brian? You know why they picked Ted and Brian? Because they have really hot
men.
No. They have really hot wives, and they're hoping there's pictures on those laptops.
Yeah,
I hate to give them good ideas.
Yeah, they're only going to search Asian laptops.
If they want to get around the Fourth Amendment issue, the part of the post that's doing the searching just has to be on the other side of the border. So just, like, rent some space from Mexico.
Dude, don't give them ideas. Mexico? Don't give them ideas. They already have enough bad ideas. It's bad enough they're doing this and refusing to justify it just so they don't have to defend it. Literally, if you read the article, that's their justification for not giving a legal basis for what they're doing, because they might have to defend it.
I'm going to search your house, and I can't give you a reason because I can't defend it.
Yeah, pretty much. So, it's just, that's why I'm even talking about it at all. Because, I mean, yeah, of course they go through your shit at the border. But it's pissing me off. It's getting to this point that it's just like, you know, we say so. Shut up. Bend over. I mean, I don't know.
Glad you got all those guns to protect yourself from tyranny.
Yeah. They've probably got more. Although,
no doubt.
Oh, it's not that they have more guns. They have armored vehicles and big things that go boom.
It's really amazing. Like, one country decides to take a small bit of parkland away. The whole country goes nuts. America just strips right after right. And people, I couldn't give a fuck. Don't take my gun. Just compare, yeah, man.
Let's next story up. Now, the story behind this story is fairly interesting because I the article I originally found, I didn't recognize the group because it's an Australian story, and something looks sketchy about it. So I thought, well, I don't have time to look into this right now. I'll ask RU about it later. And I let RU look at it, and his head exploded. He's like, no, don't use that one. Use this one. So we actually fact-checked the story. Because the original... I really do try to avoid sources that are crazy biased. I mean, you're not going to avoid bias altogether. But, I mean, I really do try to avoid it. And the article I originally found was apparently on quite the left-wing site.
And it was written by the sitting senator.
Yeah.
From his point of view.
Yeah.
Against the government. So see, we found a more legit article.
Yeah, I only cared about the technical aspects of the article. And it's like, yeah, that looks like something good. And this site looks a little odd. I'll ask RU about it. And so we got a better story for this one now. One that's not quite as... Anyways, so this article is from the age.com.au. Homestead.ru. Australia's corporate...
I'm now in domain.
We get our Australian news from Russia.
Russia.
Oh, and if anybody's wondering where RU's screen name comes from, look up the morning after pill. Where was I? Okay. Australia's corporate watchdog group has admitted to inadvertently blocking access to about 250,000 innocuous websites in addition to the 1,200 it had already accidentally censored. ASIC made the concession in the statement at a Senate estimates hearing on Tuesday night after it caused controversy by interpreting a 15-year-old law in the Telecommunications Act as giving it the ability to block websites. The largest number of sites censored when attempting to block one particular site ASIC believed was defrauding Australians was 250,000. Of these, ASIC said about 1,000 or 0.4% were active sites. It said the other 249,000 the 249,000 other sites hosted no substantive content or offered their domain name up for sale rather than hosting a fully fledged active site. No substantive content. Yeah, that guy's blog looks like a piece of shit. That doesn't count. Next.
Yeah. I was going to say, who's the judge of that?
Yeah, really. ASIC asked internet service providers to block sites it believed were defrauding Australians by IP address instead of by domain name. This meant that thousands of other sites were blocked in the process because whoever decided on that policy had no idea how web servers work, as many sites are often hosted on one shared IP address. Right. That's actually a really fun option in Apache. It can determine what pages it's going to show you by what domain you came at it from. So it's like used a lot because servers aren't the cheapest thing in the world. And it's getting to where IPs aren't either. So it'd be really nice if the people who do these policies and filters understood how the internet, you know, worked before they made decisions on these things. ASIC told Senate Estimates in its opening statement that it was now examining how it could ensure only a site-specific domain was blocked and ways it could alert the public to a site being blocked via a pop-up page. Oh, God, so now they want to insert shit in your traffic. It was also examining ways such a page could indicate why access was blocked and to whom queries could be made as to dispute a block. Yeah, it's blocked. We blocked this for opposing political views, and you can contact my ass for reasons of... ASIC Deputy Chairman Peter Kell told Estimates that the watchdog had used Section 313 of the Telecommunications Act on 10 occasions in the past year to request a number of Australian ISPs to block sites. ASIC sent the notices to four or five ISPs on each occasion. They don't know. Four or five. They don't know. God. Wow. On all 10 occasions, it requested websites to be blocked by IP address instead of by domain name. And because, you know, it's hard to change your IP, right? And another already reported case, about 1,200 sites were blocked by mistake. On the other 8 occasions, ASIC said only the targeted criminal site or the targeted site and a very small number of other sites, or some, you know, a few around it, you know. Collateral damage, shit happens.
We'd be for the shotgun method.
You know, I'm going to stop reading this now. We've read enough. The people who are deciding what to filter don't know what they're doing.
Gee, it sounds awfully similar to the people that are making laws against the internet.
Yeah, it's a fantastic job, guys. Why don't you actually read a white paper before you write this shit? Come on. But, you know, have you actually been on the internet? Do you actually have a clue what you're doing, or are you just going, IP addresses are bad. We're going to block those. Like, come on. I don't know. You're the one who would have been affected by this. Do you got anything on it?
I'm just reading the Telecommunications 313 Act right now. It's, yeah. Interesting reading. They're not responsible for any loss of trade. Government states that if they cancel your internet service because they believe you're suspiciously doing something, and even if you're not, and you go bankrupt, it doesn't matter. It's not their fault because they did it within good faith.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they're not even held responsible for their fuck up.
No, this is a... And I'm going back to 4chan.
At least it's more honest, right?
Exactly. At least a dick's a dick and not a senator.
Go ahead, Matt.
If the government bashes your head in good faith, can they be held responsible for your death?
Probably not. They're preventing you from hurting yourself. They broke your arm so you couldn't hurt yourself.
We just rescued you with extreme force. All right. I've got my mindbender story for tonight now. It's from nature.com. And this is great. Electrical engineers have used lasers to create a cloak that can hide communications in a time hole, so that it seems that they were never sent. The method, published today in Nature One, is the first that can cloak data streams sent at the rapid rates typically seen in telecommunication systems. It opens the door to ultra-secure transmission schemes and may also provide a way to better shield information from noise corruption. In 2010, Martin McCall, an optical physicist at the Imperial College of London, said his colleagues proposed that it may be possible to create a temporal cloak to carve out short windows in time during which operations can be carried out unnoticed. Their work built on the principles behind invisibility cloaks, which hide objects in space by channeling light rays around them. When viewed from a distance, the light appears to have traveled along a straight line without having hit any intervening object. Similarly, McCall and colleagues suggested that by pulling light waves apart in time and then compressing them back together, it should be possible to create time pockets, which to cloak events. In theory, this could enable a whole new level of security for data transmission along fiber optic lines, said Joseph Lukens, a electrical engineer at Purdue University in Indiana, and lead author of the latest study. It doesn't just prevent eavesdroppers from reading on your data. They wouldn't even know there's been any data to hack. Intercept, read, decode. Come on, don't use hack.
The Gibson.
We'll hack the light.
Last year, a team led by Alexander Gaeta, an optical physicist at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, built the first working temporal cloak by manipulating laser pulses. By the time the window opened up, windows opened up too rarely to be able to hide data coming in at telecommunications rates. In other words, they couldn't make it work. Well, they had it working, they just couldn't use it. To speed up the cloaking rate, Lukens and his colleagues exploited a wave phenomenon that was first discovered by British inventor Henry Fox Talbot in 1836. That's the thing where you use slits to split up wavelengths of light. So let's skip the science here because it reads like the Star Trek manual. Unfortunately, the current setup may be a little too good at hiding things. We erased the data adding event entirely from history, so there's no way that data could be sent as a useful message to anyone, even the genuine recipient, says Lukens. However, McCall is impressed with the team's effort and believes that future modifications will allow them or others to send secret messages successfully. He credits Lukens' team for significantly boosting the cloak's efficiency. This brings temporal cloaks within reach of practical applications. Ironically, the first application of temporal cloaks may not be to hide data, but to help read them more accurately. The team has showed that by splitting and recombining light waves in time creates increased periods in which main data stream can be made immune to corruption by inserted data. Pretty much, as opposed to using this to send secret messages, talking about using it to cut down on crosstalk. But they're making holes in time on a fiber optic line and then figured out that it disappeared.
in the...
We absolutely made nothing that made nothing disappear.
It never existed in the first place because they bent time around it.
That's fair. Oh, man, I should have used that for office reports. No, dude, I did it. It's just sitting in a time hole.
Perfect.
You know, but technically it exists, but it doesn't exist, and you'll never see it. But I did do it. It's in a time hole. But it exists, but it doesn't exist. But it's in a time hole. It's in a time hole. It's in a time hole.
You're in a loop.
I think we just scratched our use record.
You know what I mean? Like, maybe I'm just too retarded to get this story.
Oh, I skipped the science because it reads like the fuck. It's like, and Scotty showed up. I mean.
Maybe I need to read the whole story because I'm just not getting it. Because it makes it sound like they had a big breakthrough in making nothing, then decided that because they'd made nothing, they need to make a time hole and hide the nothing in the time hole, but they still made it.
Well, okay, here, let me read this then.
Do you know what I mean?
Lucan's team created its Talbot carpet by passing laser light through a phase modulator, a waveguide that also had an oscillating electrical voltage applied to it. As the voltage varied, the speed at which light traveled through the waveguide was altered, splitting the light into its constituent frequencies and knocking these out of step. As predicted, at regular time intervals, the separate frequencies recombined destructively to generate time holes. Lucan's team then used a second round of phase modulating to compress the energy further, expanding the duration of time windows to 36 picoseconds.
Oh, picoseconds, now I've got it.
Phase modulator waveguides, yeah. And Scotty said, more power to the warp for it.
Wow. Together we can rule the galaxy.
Go ahead, BSV.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get exactly how this is supposed to work.
They're compressing lasers on a fiber optic line and making it look like nothing was sent when something was. The problem is it works too well. You can't actually receive anything that's sent with this method.
So pretty much it's...
They failed and said they succeeded.
Yeah, but they put it in a time hole.
But that's the beauty of being a scientist. Be like, look what I made. It's nothing. Amazeballs.
Okay. Finish that. I'm sorry, man.
So technically, so they're sending stuff that looks like it's not there. So they're sending lightless fiber optic signals.
Yeah, I think they could have just knocked the cable loose and not noticed. You're right. But the time hole write-up is good.
Dang it!
That is...
This fiber optic isn't even working correctly.
Well, you see, Your Honor, I did my taxes. But there's this thing. I sent it on lasers, and now it's stuck in a time hole.
We're going to be hearing time holes for, like, a month now. Be at Gen Con and be making jokes about the time hole.
I'll get you a beer, man. Oh, I left it in the time hole. Sorry.
Oh.
I swear I ordered a ticket, but it must have fell in a time hole.
All right, let's do this. All right, I got a couple of different things for Digital Dojo tonight. First one I wanted to touch on for people with the Raspberry Pi who've been playing around with it. The article I have is from H Online, but it's actually at raspberrypi.org that you download this. A new installation system for the Raspberry Pi allows users to experiment more easily with different Linux systems on the device, called Noobs, which is one of the reasons I wanted to cover it. They actually called the software Noobs, new out of box software. The software installs onto a 4GB or larger SD card and offers a choice of operating systems upon first boot. I guess to explain a little bit, with a Raspberry Pi, normally you have to image an SD card with a Linux build. It's usually a Raspbian or PyDora or one of the XBMC builds or Arch, whatever. Well, what they've done is they've worked up a zip file that's got a couple of different... operating systems in it. So instead of having to go through an imaging process, you just unzip it onto an SD card, and when it boots up, you tell it which one you want. And I played with it a little bit. It's not bad. It saves you the time of DDing an image file into an SD card. You just, you know, unzip it and drop the files on it. So I don't know. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of neat. Mostly they're putting it out there to help people who can't figure out how to image an SD card. But I can also think of a couple of other uses of just since you're just copying files onto the card, it's probably a little bit easier to deal with if you're wanting to back up your SD card, stuff like that.
I was going to say, and installing different OSs, it sounds like. I mean, if there's an installer, you can
It's got a couple of different... Dear God, are you? What the hell is that? I should not click links during the show. Somebody's been playing with the time hole again. I should know better than that. That scared me a little bit. I forgot what I was saying.
Can you imagine that thing running at you at the front door? For all those with phobia of spiders.
I General, bring me my brown pants. Wow. Anyways, yeah, what Noobs does is it comes with Raspbian, Pydora, and a couple of versions of XBMC. And when you first boot it up, it inflates the image onto the SD card of whichever operating system you chose. And then after that, that SD card just runs that operating system. And when it's booting up, you can hold down shift and get back into the menu and switch to a different one. So it's kind of neat, and it seems like a quick way to rebuild. You know, like if you're just trying it out and switching between a couple of different operating systems just to play with it, it is. It's a quick way to get a card set up. It's kind of cool. So
cool.
And, yeah. You know, you don't have to drop, you know, WinImage 32 on your work machines, which means getting around admin privileges. So anyways, I thought Suave would be more in on that one since he's played with Raspberry Pi stuff.
Sorry, man. I've got my OS. I like it. I don't want to change it.
What are you running on yours?
Raspbian.
Fair enough. All right. Well, next thing I have for Digital Dojo is on GitHub. Somebody has put together, the guy's screen name is Wackashu, has put together a nice set of guides and scripts for creating your own Tor hidden service and attempting to keep it secure. He's got a write-up on how to create a virtual machine that runs a web server on Tor. And you can only get to it through Tor. It's, you know, it's one of the .onion sites. It's a series of walkthroughs and scripts to help you build a Ubuntu virtual machine and then get the web server up and running. So that's cool. You know, if you're wanting to set up a site and the way they're monitoring and every damn thing, wrapping it in a virtual machine and keeping the whole mess encrypted is probably not a bad idea if you're wanting to at least attempt to keep it private. And but I would recommend actually reading the scripts before you run them, just so you see what it's doing to your machine, because it is GitHub. GitHub has been compromised before, so one, assuming this guy has put together a decent set of scripts and he's not just trying to build a botnet. Because I never had time to skin the scripts. So if you're going to run them, I would check them. But his write-up looked fairly good. So even if you don't use his scripts, you can at least look at his write-ups and get an idea for how to go about doing some of this stuff. And, of course, if you're going to get on Tor, you need something to access it with. So I've got a link in the show notes for Tails. If you don't know what Tails is a live CD that runs a modified version of Debian that gets on Tor, and that's all it's for. And it's crazy paranoid. It doesn't touch the hard drive of what you run it on. It doesn't. It actually wipes the RAM when you shut the thing down. And it really bitches at you if you run it in a virtual machine. It complains. So hardcore privacy operating system on that one.
Nice.
So that's really pretty much all I had for the show tonight. Listen to the stream. We're always working on it, always looking for new content to add. Of course, Pure Decking on Thursdays. I have nothing on Saturdays. The Missing Dialogues on Tuesdays. When we start the drinking show or think of a better name for it, I'll add that to the promo list here. Of course, hit the Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handle, the feedback forum, the subreddit. Sending horrible, horrible email to RU. Find horrible pictures and send them to RU and label this Pure Decking feedback. That's. I don't know. Did anybody have anything they wanted to throw out before I close out the show here? I need the cricket sound.
I'm pretty good.
There we go. All right, I'm going to hit play on this.
Thank you.